Well, good evening and welcome to this live stream event on the 8th of September 2020. Martin North is my name, Principal of Digital Finance Analytics. Thank you very much indeed for spending some time with us this evening. And I've got Tony Lecantro from Perth ready to come on board in just a second. As normal, though, there's just a few comments I want to make before we start, just to make sure that we're all on the same page. And very importantly, I just need to underscore that we're not providing financial advice tonight. Please also do play nice in the chat room. No racial slurs. The stream is being moderated. Plexus is doing a great job. Thanks once again, Plexus. Appreciate that. This is as at the 8th of September 2020, if you're watching this in replay. And if you want to get a question asked, then use at Walk the World to make sure that I see it, because there's always plenty going on the chat, and sometimes I don't necessarily see everything that's going on the chat. And I've also enabled Super Chat, which means that firstly, you can make sure that your question goes right to the top of the queue. And secondly, you can also make a donation to help us with the channel. That is greatly appreciated, because essentially this is very much run on the smell of an oily rag. And I think at the current environment with so much going on, this is probably a channel which is more important than ever in terms of thinking about future financial plans and all of those things. So I think there's a real role for us. So please feel free to support us if you'd like to. So without further ado, let me bring Tony in. So let me first switch that across and then switch the audio on. Tony, you should be with us. Hello.
Good evening, Martin, and good evening, viewers. It's been a while since I've done one of these shows, and certainly looking forward to it. But I could argue that The Bachelor is on tonight, and that might be of greater financial benefit for some people.
you think they should go watch that instead? Well, maybe, yeah. Hopefully they'll stick with us, Tony.
Anyway, for the women appearing on that show, a win's probably their financial freedom. But yeah, certainly interesting times, and such a great service you're running, Martin. I've been catching up with a lot of your shows, and this is the best content you'll ever get on any program based on the real world. So no, certainly looking forward to tonight.
Well, thank you for that, Tony. And it is interesting how the audience has grown over the years. And what's interesting, I've had a number of people who've been silent followers for several years, in fact, quite often, reach out for me in the last couple of months saying, you know, we listen to you, and because of that, we're in a much better financial position. We haven't, you know, bought that investment property, or we've done this or done that, right? So actually, it's really great to realize that we can make a difference with some of these conversations. And hopefully people who've been following us are more prepared and more willing and able to negotiate the complexities that are there currently. Now, we've got a lot to get through tonight, but I think a really good place to start, Tony, would be Christopher Joy's article, because of course he came out at the weekend essentially saying everything's fine, nothing to see here, and there might be a slight wobble, but effectively there's still a 20% upside of property. So what was your reaction to that?
I'll put up the headline so viewers can see it.
That's
so
good.
Yeah, pretty much what he's saying is that everywhere is starting to stabilize, even in Perth, but we've still got issues in Melbourne. And he's still talking about 0 to -5% move in prices, which I think's quite delusional, to be honest. I disagree totally with that view. And I just think that we're probably looking towards falls well in excess of the 35-40%, Martin.
Well, I go back to your bet with a kook, right? Because effectively that's still valid, isn't it?
Yeah, it's an interesting scenario is that we've had all these stimulus, we've had the deferral of loans, and we still haven't seen high volumes come onto the market. But I want to remind viewers of two of the ugliest words you're ever going to hear in property, and those two words are price discovery. Because when you've got 800,000 residential mortgages and business loans deferred, it's only going to take a small number of people in a suburb or in a street to panic sell, and then suddenly the real estate agent will come in and say, well, look, these are the sales I have in the area, and there the price declines are pretty much going to snowball. And I can see this happening to a lot of suburbs, even the so-called more affluent suburbs at all. And I guess real estate agents have to eat. They have to earn a living. And as I've said many times before, once the volume comes in, it'll be like trying to suck an ocean through a straw, and you're effectively trying to panic sell into an illiquid market. And if the key executives of the big four banks are saying now's the time to consider selling, well, guess what? It's probably already too late. And my acronym for that scenario, Mountain, is GTFON.
Which means?
Get the frig out now, pretty much.
Okay, very good. Yeah, well, yep. Ross McEwen, of course, a couple of weeks ago from NAB, you know, actually came up with the most overt comment that I think I've heard from a mainstream banker, which says there will be some people that would do better to sell. But of course, he was reflecting on his experience through the global financial crisis up in the Northern Hemisphere when he was, part of RBS, right? And I think that's important because the international perspective on what happens in a crisis is something that has really passed most of Australia by, if you think about it, simply because the fact is that most people here think that property only ever doubles in 7 years or whatever the number is, right? But anybody who's been around will know that after the global financial crisis, prices fell for the following 4 to 5 years in both the UK, Ireland, and in the US, that the worst of the defaults happened not in the first year or the second year, but the third year, and that prices ended up 40% down for many people. And in fact, they were trapped in negative equity for a decade. Now, I'm not saying it's going to be precisely the same here, but the fact is that those give you some of the parameters that we might want to think about in terms of what may happen ahead. So it's pretty important that people actually have a realistic view, not this rose-tinted stuff that some people are still spruiking.
Absolutely. And you can't have house price levels relative to income anywhere above 10. A lot of the US places during the GFC crashed at 7. And I think we're still in this delusional pricing environment where people think, well, wait a sec, I've got a chance of getting back to the 2017 highs. Now, as we know, in 2017, the world went batshit crazy on speculation, and that extended to Bitcoin, to all financial classes, all battery metals, and included Eastern States real estate. So I think what another important chart is this one here. Now, I think that is probably the scariest chart you're actually ever going to see, I think, based on the fact that if you look at the constant quality real house prices, now this chart allows for improvements in houses. So this is as close to accurate as you can get. And you can see there that prices can stagnate for over 50 years. And we see the first spike at the end of World War II, where you can expect men came home, people, families decided to buy a house. But that to me is an extremely ugly chart. And you can see the acceleration in real house prices when wages are also disconnected and we had negative gearing. So based on that chart, It's frightening to see how high prices have come relative to wages, relative to any economic reasoning. And we might get a short-term sharp 30, 40% correction, but we could also have decades of little or no growth, which will pretty much dispel that long myth, which I think is a load of shit, that house prices should double every 7 years. So I think if viewers take away anything, it's realizing that property isn't a sure bet at all.
Yeah, absolutely, Tony. And the point about that is that, there are many younger people who actually have never experienced anything other than astronomical growth, right? But as I say, and you say too, that's unusual, right? And we had a bunch of reasons: deregulation, very low interest rates, particularly after the global financial crisis, and frankly government policy as well, which built the multiples way up. And it's interesting, Alan Kohler on his piece tonight actually showed a chart from, I think, Minters or somebody like that, who actually compared the GDP. And basically, there was also a hookup at the end there too. So in other words, on every measure you can think of, what we've had in the last decade or so, and particularly in the last few years, is unusual. And it signals that, yeah, either prices will fall, or if they don't fall, they're going to go sideways. The chance of them going any higher from where they currently are is, I reckon, close to zero.
I couldn't agree more than that. And I think our financial literacy levels in Australia are as close to zero as you can get. But can you actually imagine a couple sitting down at the dinner table and assessing the risk rewards of selling their outer Western Sydney house for $1.5 million, where it's going to fall below a million, looking at where's the growth going to come from? Is this outer Western Sydney area or East Broken Hill going to become an important economic hub to rival New York or London? I just think we're in this fairyland in Australia. And I've been through, in my 22 years of advising clients on speculative stocks, I've copped a lot of beatings along the way. And it wasn't that long leading into the GFC where mortgage rates were approaching 10%. And I know that people say you're crazy that interest rates will never rise, but the long-term mortgage rate is 9.41%. It's probably a bit lower now. The average RBA cash rate is 6.5%. Now, how the hell can someone with an $800,000 mortgage pay back $72,000 a year in interest only on an asset that's worth $500,000? I think being sandpapered to death would be more fun than that.
Well, the fact is that we, of course, have one-third of the population mortgaged, right? So this mortgage debt is not across the whole population. We've got one-third renting, one-third effectively mortgage-free, right? But what's interesting, if you look at those with mortgages, they hold the mortgage for longer, so they tend to go into retirement with the mortgage now. The mortgage is bigger, so it's eating a greater share of their income. And even with interest rates absolutely rock bottom, the amount they're actually paying as a proportion of their income and in absolute terms is still very high, much higher than it used to be. So wherever you look, however you sort of frame the argument, Tony, you know, there is very little argument other than it's going to be painful ahead. It'll be very complex as well. And then, of course, if prices do fall, then you have negative equity as well. And I think negative equity is the other thing that people need to understand, as well as price discovery, because price discovery is, you know, what will happen in the market when you try and sell. But negative equity is, if you don't sell, if you can continue to make that mortgage repayment, you're locked into the property. And of course, that was happening in the UK and in Ireland. So many people were stuck in the property, couldn't sell it because they have less value in the property relative to their mortgage. And I think negative equity is something else that people are going to have to get used to ahead.
Well, I think for some people, look, we're not going to have cash for keys here and in Australia, as we saw on 99 Homes. But I think some families, I know they're not going to break even on their purchase. I know they've paid astronomical stamp duty. They've paid all the moving costs. But sometimes taking a $50,000, $100,000 hit now, sorting out your debt scenario with the bank and walking away is going to be a lot of a less painful experience than copping years of negative equity and finally probably being forced to sell at the absolute bottom and your situation's magnified. So I actually don't think the Australian public, on the whole, those with mortgages, have any idea what's approaching. We have an economy that's heading back to the 1970s. There's going to be the less is more economy. We've just peaked in this bullshit BNPL bubble, which is buy now, pay later, where curbside collections in 2 years are going to resemble a flea market. Australians have gone absolutely crazy buying stuff, absolute garbage. The new car market got slaughtered. There's still incentives to go out and buy new cars. People are loading up on clothes, ridiculous purchases, because they've been given this sugar hit from the government. And once all this stimulus ends, there's not going to be the employment we've had once before. People aren't going to be paid $100,000 plus to go hold a hose at a mine site. I just think there's a lot of excess properties, financial wizardry, all these people that own multiple homes in an economy that's going to contract severely. So it is an absolute shitstorm approaching. All these surplus stimulus, whatever you call it, is just delaying the absolute inevitable. And I implore any family under balance sheet pressure, now's the time to liquidate, sell what you can, cancel your 10 various subscriptions, don't take up Disney Plus or Apple TV, but you've got to sandbag your balance sheet for your family's well-being. But sadly, for a lot of people, it's like throwing a feather into a cyclone.
Yeah, well, it's interesting, Tony, because many people, of course, don't even actually have a basic cash flow, so they actually don't know what they're spending and what they're actually earning. And I keep recommending the Money Smart website, because on there's a very, very good financial planning tool that allows people to put in essentially, you know, what they're spending and what they're earning, so they can see where they are. That's really a very basic way of beginning to get your head around how your finances really are. And I'm fascinated in my surveys, because I actually ask them both subjectively, do they think they've got a financial problem? And then we look at the data based on what they tell us, right? And there's a massive mismatch. So many people still think they're fine, when in fact, anybody who looks at their money in, money out, will say, no, you're not fine. You know, you're surviving by buy now, pay later, credit cards or whatever. But essentially, the cash flow shows it all. And so I think it's really important that that people get to grips with the cash flow. And by the way, the other point I'd make, Tony, is that property investors are probably some of the worst, because the number of people who own investment properties who've never worked out what their real return is absolutely shocking, on the assumption that, well, the capital growth always go up, so I'm always going to be better off, when, of course, the truth is way, way different.
Yeah, absolutely. And not many people are able to go to a soccer game with all the other kids in their six-figure Euro SUV and be upfront about how much it costs to maintain a property, how much are the council rates, how much is the rewiring and all the repairs. So what I've worked out in my life is I've become a minimalist. I'm back in a one-bedroom unit. There's no way known to man I've got any interest in becoming a property investor, because I think sentiment in this country is going to be shot to shit once we realise what the true financial damage of this property dream spells for investors and owner-occupiers. So I just think it's a quantum shift in our sentiment, that if you could get on the property ladder before it's too late, what a load of crap. And the other thing families should take into consideration is all these new estates in Perth where the government's throwing money at low-income earners to build is ridiculous, because that's just, you're going to actually cannibalise your own resale value if you're building in established areas. And I know personally of one very low income earner who's being forced to build a new home because of the free money. But again, around Perth, we're going to have these mortgage prisons. At least some of them are by the ocean up at Alkimos, and some in the Canning Vale area as well, which we've seen before. So the financial literacy people won't realise that in Perth, you can go 30 kilometres out and get a three-bedroom house on 600 square metres thereabouts for around $200,000. You redo the kitchen and bathroom, and that's an asset. But going out to an area like that, paying $200,000 for land and building a $300,000-$400,000 house is financial suicide, and that's what a lot of people are doing.
Yeah, well, it's interesting what happened, of course, with the government support, state and Fed. 55K was the amount that people can get. And guess what? Land house package went up by 55K before it started, it was a zero-sum game. And then you're right, it spills over, so existing property gets depressed in the surrounding area. I'm already seeing it.
So it what is, happened to the free Toyota Yaris? They don't give away free cars anymore.
No, well, that's right. Yeah. Though interestingly, some banks are now offering lenders mortgage insurance for a dollar.
Okay. It's like upgrading a single bed to a king size for a dollar at Harvey Norman. Yeah, that sounds good, Martin. Where do I sign up?
It is pretty amazing, isn't it? And if you stand back and think about it. But I guess probably one question I had was, and one or two people have been asking about this, you know, is Victoria really the cause of all this? And was the latest lockdown? Or are we seeing something more structural? Now, your chart indicates that effectively those house prices were already accelerating away and they've been going, you know, way off scale for quite some time. So in a way, the issues around the virus have just laid bare what was already happening rather than it being the cause of everything. I mean, because you and I were both saying similar things before the lockdowns.
Well, I think humans throughout time have a tolerance to pain. They have a tolerance to putting up with their partners, but they also have a tolerance to paying a certain level of their income on housing and being a certain level in debt. That's why long-term price-to-income ratios have always been 5 to 6 times, not 13 times as we've recently seen. I think all speculative rallies get exhausted when there's no fuel left, people become bored, the early adapters start to take profits, and it's just your standard off-the-shelf speculative bubble. But sadly, we've had a global pandemic. I mean, I'm not going to buy into conspiracy theories at all. It's 890,000 people have died around the world. We've got people dying in aged care facilities. We have global travel at a standstill. I mean, I feel for all those 20,000 Qantas employees who've just lost their jobs. But the fall in house prices to reality was going to happen anyway, as it has happened in every other globally insignificant city on earth, such as New York, Los Angeles, and London, Martin.
Point well made, Tony. Point well made, right? This is structural, right?
It's structural. It's human tolerance to paying rubbish prices to buy something that's not worth the money. I mean, heaven help all those people that have gone out. You see houses in Mindari, which is north of Perth, nice, you know, by the water. And some of these people put bowling alleys in them, for God's sake. Oh, who wants a frigging tennis court these days? So Australians have gone absolutely nuts on debt. It's time to get back to basics. Housing is shelter. The easy money cannot be won anymore. And as I said, we're going back to the 70s. Kids need to learn to sleep in bunk beds. Not every kid should demand a backyard because there's parks everywhere. It's absolutely structural, Martin.
Yeah, and I think that's really the point, right? So people who are hoping that this is a temporary situation and essentially, you know, the virus will get nailed one way or the other and then we'll be bouncing back to where we were, right? And the politicians still talk about bouncing back or, you know, resetting to where we were. And of course, some of the policies are still dusting off the ones they had previously, right? This is a fundamental structural shift, which I think will probably echo down for at least a generation or two. And I think it's about what priorities are. I think it's about you know, what's important in life. And frankly, you know, the consumer-driven society, remember the half of the economy in Australia is GDP relating to consumer expenditure, right? It's unlikely that we're going to see that return anytime soon, in my view, which means that the whole economic foundation that we're actually going to build the next generation on is going to have to be rather different. And that has a policy and an economic and a personal challenge like no other.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I've just come off probably the busiest time of my career. I've done well because I've put clients in the right stocks and I've backed the right companies. And I've had some mild delusions of grandeur, I must admit. I was thinking about upgrading my second car. And my partner said, you live less than 4 kilometres from work and the city, pull your head in. And maybe I should just go and rent one for a week. And, you know, things become a habit in 21 days. I just think, and I start looking at the properties and I'm thinking, no, wait a sec. I'd rather go to the shops and buy 2 decent pieces of ribeye than worry about how I'm going to pay for the bloody mortgage. And it's not that expensive either.
Yeah, yeah. No, good point. And look, it's worth, I think, just pausing here and recognizing that the AFR reported today that the banks are going to fund government stimulus, right? So basically, there's an idea being mooted, whether it's completely true, who knows, but effectively the banks will be buying local authority bonds and other financial instruments to build up their balance sheet as a sort of a quasi-stimulus, which is another way of doing QE without doing QE, right? And this is another sign of desperation on the part of the regulators to try and keep this Ponzi scheme going further, right? It seems to me quite amazing that, the only antidote for all the issues we've got, according to the Reserve Bank and the government, is more debt. And yet it seems to me that the last thing on earth we actually need at the moment is yet more debt. We need to actually right-size it rather than just explode it even more.
Yeah, I think what we seriously need is an economic reset. It's going to hurt a lot of people. There's no doubt that that's going to happen, I guess. And then we're going to have decades of nothingness. But we just, as you said, we just can't keep throwing all this money at people. It's like supporting a child in your house to the age of 40. Eventually, kids are resilient. You've got to send them out. People just can't keep handed this income, so JobKeeper, so to speak. But at some point, people need to fend for themselves. And we just can't become like that. And sadly, there's going to be a lot of economic pain to come. Those that have become wealthy on buying one property, having it revalued, borrowing more, et cetera, those days are over. We will get back to basics, but the only way to see this economy prosper and grow is for the mother of all resets, a cleansing recession. We're going to have a lot of pain, a lot of excess removed. You've got to look at a lot of the office space now. This work from home culture isn't going away in a hurry. We've seen counter arguments saying we still need to go in and feel part of a team. I mean, I'm quite happy to work up to 5 days a week from home. All this office space now, there's talk of rebuilding residential areas around unused office space. I mean, when does it stop?
Well, it's not as if we've got an undersupply of property, right? We've got 1.2 million spare properties already across Australia, and there's more being built even now, and more building approvals at a slower rate, but still going on. And just throwing more money at the construction sector to try and actually build our way out of this makes absolutely no sense at all. And yet, that is central policy. And it's worth reflecting, Tony, in another piece of data that came out today was the latest unemployment rate, right? Which, according to Roy Morgan, is now sitting at something like 13.8%, right? Which is huge, right? I mean, that's a really big number. But the unemployed and underemployed together is still more than one in five. So 22.8%, according to Roy Morgan. I prefer the Roy Morgan statistics to the ABS ones. I think they're more accurate. I mean, those are just horrible numbers. And then if you think about things like the ABS number, which went up a little, the ABS number doesn't actually really reflect the true reality of what's going on. And, of course, we've also had the business confidence dropping through the floor as well. So, all of the leading indicators are suggesting that we have an economy in free fall, and yet the conversation is about debt and more debt, building more property, helping the construction sector. And I've even heard the construction sector arguing for everybody should be able to access their super to be able to buy more houses, right? It's like, don't people understand what happens when you effectively get into this one-way system? You can't just continue to do the same thing and expect a different outcome. I mean, that is, well, insanity, isn't it?
It certainly is the definition of it. And taking this path certainly isn't going to work. I don't think the company failures rate has really accelerated yet. And we look at the tourism industry, you look at the cruise industry, you look at the revamped Virgin with significant layoffs. I was planning to go overseas mid next year. I don't think that's going to happen. And I think people are becoming more insulated. They're not going to want to go risk being at public events. I just think, people, admittedly, they're spending a lot of money online. They've been handed all this money, all these offers. But in the end, it's not the way out of it. We're not going to be able to spend our way out of it. Unfortunately, we do have to have quite a lot of pain, quite a lot of job losses. We do have, I'm hoping that the mental health issues start to slow down, but I can't see that happening. No doubt we're going to have more suicides. I don't know how people are going to cope. And at the moment, I think for some families, honestly, we'd probably be hoping that this goes on a little bit longer, because they do have a mechanism to ward off the debt collectors, their banks and their utility bills. But I think once we start to come out of it, and those who've had a job, I think that's when desperation is going to increase. I think mental health issues will accelerate along with suicides. And apart from those angry men walking the streets of Melbourne, I think we'll start to see some social unrest and might even start seeing some looting here, Martin. So something I'm not looking forward to, but unfortunately, if we keep taking this path, that's where we're heading.
Yeah, interesting. And I was watching the chat here. Mark just said, well, do you think the government will let, quote unquote, property prices fall 30 to 40%, right? And there's two observations about one that. One is, well, they probably will try to stop it, but do they actually have the ammunition to be able to turn it around? Because my calculation is they need to spend something like 800 billion to be able to actually try and support the property market into the next 5 to 8 years, something like that. In fact, the scheme that was talked about in the AFR, I showed you earlier on, is more than 200 billion, which is what I calculated roughly it would be to save the banks. So effectively, it seems to me that it's more likely that what they will do is support financial stability, but probably accept that property prices will have to fall. And the trouble is that once they start moving down, it's very, very hard to stop them. I don't know of any bubble anywhere that effectively doesn't ultimately deflate and come down. And I know people keep saying Australia is unique and different, Tony, but I have a feeling that on this one we aren't really, and there are many examples around the world.
Well, how long can a property market stay at 13 times price to income outside of Hong Kong? It's never happened, and it never will. And you look at the Irish, their prices halved. New York, every major city, London, we get that nasty price correction, and that happens regardless of any outside events. So I can't see how people, unfortunately, in a $1 million house with no income can be propped up by the government. And you have others with multiple properties that might have paid off their mortgage and thinking, well, hey, wait a sec, here's a lot I win tax-free. I think we should sell, because our capital gain is going to disappear. And then again, it's like a sandbag to a tsunami. People don't realize is you've got all these non-mortgaged homeowners sitting on tax-free lotto wins that can fund their retirement. And I think selling begets selling. So at the moment, we're in this status quo. Banks are saying, hey, get the hell out. We're not nowhere near those two ugly words, which I'll repeat again, price discovery, which basically stipulates how the market operates and how a real estate agent survives. So there's a lot of stock out there waiting to be sold into no buyers. It'll be like the day the NASDAQ died way back in 2000.
Yeah, and it's worth saying, I think, Tony, that this isn't going to happen overnight, right? Remember what I said earlier on about this is 2 or 3 years. This is going to be a long, slow grind, right? And we'll see more and more properties probably coming on. I think also the banks are starting to put pressure on property investors already. I've already had a few people explain what's happened in the recent conversations between the banks. They were on interest and principal repayment holidays. They're coming to an end. And the banks basically said, look, you're a property investor. There's really not much prospect of this property turning around anytime soon. Better to sell. And, I know you've said, and I just want to reemphasize, if you're going to panic early.
Well, it goes back to 2014. We built a 5x2 in Victoria Park, roughly 6 kilometres from the city, and we had an interest-only loan. And then suddenly the the reset came in and we're looking at an additional 30% on our mortgage. And the stock market was a bit shaky then. And I said to my wife at the time, look, we've got to get the hell out. And we're just fortunate we had this beautiful property. We're expecting a lineup of buyers at the home open and there was donuts. Not one person showed up. And luckily one person gave us a reasonable offer and we took it. Now, once you get that letter saying your repayments are going up, you start to pay interest, it's demoralizing. I was actually quite embarrassed, but we were fortunate enough to panic first. I mean, and that was 2014. A lot of people that bought houses in 2004, 2005 in Perth in 2020 are still underwater. Yeah. So I think what's happened to us is certainly spreading east.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because I've done some modelling at the postcode level. I shared a few of these on Twitter and on my show, and it's amazing if you look at some of the Perth trends. You know, there's been really no growth for quite some time, and in fact, quite often the price is low. Mandurah prices are 38 off. And I pick on Mandurah, I know, but look, the point is, this is a really archetypal example of what could happen when everything goes wrong. And you end up with very low prices and all the social issues and those things too. So, you know, I hope people understand that what we see in those sorts of postcodes could well spread more widely. I mean, the stress data that I shared the other day shows 40% of households are now in mortgage stress, which is a horrible number. And many of them are really struggling to know what to do. So, Tony, look, we've spoken quite a lot about property. Let's just move the conversation forward. I just want to touch on two things. Firstly, the markets generally, because last time we spoke, which was about 3 or 4 months ago, the markets had dropped dramatically, right? And then they've come hurtling back up again. What's your read on that? And do you think the markets generally are, you know, in stupid territory, or is there a reason why they are where they are at the moment?
Yeah, good point. The way I see it is this rebound in the Dow Jones up to around 28,000 points. It's been largely driven by the tech sector. We do have just a handful of companies such as your Apple, Amazon and other companies that have pretty much dominated the market. Now, when the Dow Jones was around that 19,000 point mark, I would have been happy for just a small bounce, but it seems that the markets are now pricing in absolute perfection. And the way I see it is once we start to come out of COVID, once a vaccine finally makes it and we start to see it roll out, I think markets will actually get sold off on good news. So I think, you know, our market and the US are both overpriced. A lot of stocks have broken away from any economic reality or valuation. So what I've been doing with my clients is betting against markets is a very tough thing to do. Often the only winner will be the warrant or option issuer. But there are two ETFs. One is the BBUS, which bets against the US market. So I've been buying that for clients. And the other one is the BBOZ, which is against the Australian market. Now, for every 1% the ASX 200 accumulation index falls, you can expect between 2 and 2.75% return on that. And these performed exceptionally well during COVID. I'm actually going to try and share a chart of that during the COVID capitulation. So That's a chart of the BBOZ, which is the bearish Australian ETF, which you can trade. And as you can see that during the height of the capitulation, when the Dow Jones was losing just under 2,000 points a night, that performed exceptionally well. And what I've said to my clients is, you need to have exposure to these two ETFs based on the fact that, especially in Australia, Our indices are heavily dominated by banks, and we're yet to see any sign of a banking crisis, yet the major banks outside of CBA have all halved over the last 5 years. So my theory is when I say to clients, look, let's buy these, but ultimately, I do not want these ETFs to be the best performers, but it's a mild form of insurance which goes totally with my economic reasoning. So that's the BBOZ, which I think is certainly worthwhile. And I'll just try and find the other one. Now, I think the US markets, I don't know what they're trying to factor in. Who knows? Leading up to the election, I just think we're going to see a lot of increased volatility. Ultimately, over time, the earnings are going to catch up or lack thereof. Let's face it. A lot of these, maybe the tech companies will have earnings, but you look more towards bricks and mortar and other companies, the earnings just won't be there. So again, you can see how well this ETF performed as the US market was getting clobbered. So I would much rather have funds in these, you know, there's no dividends, but I'd much prefer to be exposed to these ETFs than any financial stock or major industrial in Australia, Martin.
Yeah, very interesting, Tony. And, you know, there are lots of different opinions about what's going on. I've seen in the chat, John Adams was saying, no, you're underestimating the amount of printing that's going on, and that's going to create huge inflationary pressures, and, you know, financial assets are going to go through the roof. And, you know, and there's this fundamental, you know, division. Inflation, deflation. Which way is it going to go, right? I actually don't know at the moment. I mean, I think there's a lot of arguments as to why that will be very inflationary, but I also think there are lots of arguments to support why it could be deflationary. And I look at Japan and think, well, is that where we could end up? And I guess, you know, what you're showing there is that the normal relationships between stock performance and, you know, returns are bust. So therefore, you need to find different channels and different approaches to try and actually deal with these levels of uncertainty.
Well, I think I've said this quite a few times before, that Sydney house prices at the peak were just as expensive relative to the Nikkei index in 1989. So that's absolutely ludicrous. So I still think that what we're going to see in Australia is similar to what has happened in Ireland. That similar style collapse, even leading up to that, Ireland was experiencing 6.5% economic growth. We had that beautiful YouTube argument between Morgan Kelly and Jim Power. And I implore anyone to watch that. I've tweeted it quite a few times. Now, look, I honestly, I don't give a shit about conspiracy theories, Martin. Life is far too short. I'm here to protect my family, to make my clients money, to try and enjoy life. Every economic reasoning tells me that the US market is overpriced and is going lower once we get through the election, once the reality is of the lack of earnings. The Australian market is overpriced, even though bank stocks, as I said, outside the CBA have halved. You look at gold and silver. Gold's done its job beautifully up to about $1,920. Silver's $26.71 thereabouts. But what has poleaxed Australian investors is this synchronized world of shit where our dollar, instead of being 53, is closer to 73. And to me, that's why in Australian dollars, the gold price hasn't done a lot. So, I mean, there's always something that can counter it. But, I mean, these instruments, these ETFs are long-term instruments. You've got no time decay. The company takes out futures contracts against them. You can buy them like any ordinary share. But I'm not going to wait for rampant inflation. No, there's no way known to man. This is going to be a very, very deep recession. We're going to need a reset. Now, you know, I quite enjoy John. We've met in Perth, but I'm just going to stick to basics and not try and look for anything. I mean, untoward. I'm just going to stick to what I know. If there is massive inflation and indices double from here again, these are going to drop quite a bit. But I'd certainly bet on owning this rather than not. And I can't see how people that have won lotto are suddenly going to be gifted a Powerball win, but how much is a loaf of bread going to cost?
Interesting questions there, Tony. And you know, your point about the exchange rate is really important, because it seems to me that people are underestimating the impact of that shift from what 50 something to 70 something, right? Which means that effectively any profits overseas are now actually worth less here in Australian terms. And it also means that local businesses will find it harder to compete potentially, which is going to be another downdraft on business. And I look at my business surveys, and so many businesses are actually saying we may not be around in 6 months' time. So, you know, if you start lining up all of those negative forces, I still am not totally convinced that it is fully inflationary. I mean, and a lot of people will say, no, it's obvious, right? And go buy gold, etc. But I'm just not so convinced yet. Let's see how it plays out. But I guess the other point, Tony, is that you do spend a lot of time in small caps, right? And I know that that's a particular area of interest of yours. So what have your observations have been in recent times? And somebody's been asking about some of the gold miners, for example. What's your perspective on those now, given what's happened with regard to the gold price and the exchange rate?
Yeah, the gold stocks kind of have a bit of a run. The majors in particular, because they're basically driven by institutional money flow and hoping that they don't have an all-encompassing disappointing production report. So this is a bad example, but Northern Star, I've been involved in that leap to production over the last 10 years. That was from a 5-cent capital raising to a peak, I think not far off $16. But what's happened is you've seen the gold price get to 2000, come off back to 1920, but you've seen the increase in the Aussie dollar as well. So they're now trading just over $13. You've seen the likes of Saracen back to $5, Ramelius about 219, Regis, similar decline, Newcrest are back to about $31. So I think these major gold stocks are going to go through periods of exhilaration, and then I think they're going to start to turn lethargic. But any future corrections, you'd be certainly looking at the major gold producers as opposed to the banks, Martin. And there's also a lack of silver investment opportunities on the ASX, but there was some attention, and you can make money in these precious metal stocks. But I will point out to viewers is that there has been a number of discoveries. De Grey, for example, 6 cents to about $1.48 today. That's priced for absolute perfection. So people have to be mindful that the key with these stocks is to sell at the height of the exploration excitement, because once they start going into studies to produce, they become orphans and they become unloved. So, I mean, I know I've got a client in De Grey at 6 cents. He's still got some left. I said, well, they're close to $1.50. You should sell some. And then he says, no, Tony, they're going to $2. So how can I compete with that knowledge and foresight?
Polish the crystal ball, Tony.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, but I mean, it does highlight the issues that the level of uncertainty, right, pretty much wherever you look across the markets is probably higher than it's been. Although I noticed that the volatility indexes are not quite as mad as they were, which is in itself an interesting observation. But it does make it very hard to pick markets and pick stocks. And we've touched on it before, but I think it's just worth reflecting again on your approach is not really trading more. It's sort of a little bit more informed than trading, isn't it? So just let's unpack your approach to, how you come to the market and how you look for opportunities. Because I think that's a really interesting conversation.
Yeah, I think markets generally are a collective of the population with NFI, what they're doing. So really, from my 22 years of advising, most people have no idea what they're doing, and that's what creates an actual market. So I try and identify companies with strong management that are undervalued. I can do a basic back of the envelope, or who uses them these days, back of the envelope valuation on a company. I then look at the top 20, I look at the track records of the management team, and then I apply some fortune telling to that. And what's happened this year is, apart from some of the gold stocks we've done exceptionally well, I have been involved in a number of stocks that have had medical breakthroughs, mainly Dimerics, which has a kidney drug, which has had some outstanding results. And that's gone from 8 cents to about a high of 77 for us. And a lot of that gain was in the last 12 months. So I also identified a canine cancer company called Pharmost, which has a repurposed drug for treating dogs rather than going through chemo. And I raised their money at 2.5 cents, and I think we peaked at 27. But we're all sweating tonight. There's a major announcement coming in that stock tomorrow if the vet giant Elanco is going to continue the option on the Monipantel, which is a treatment for canine cancer. But my other biotech, Proteomics, has a predictive test for chronic diabetic kidney disease, which has shown it works. That's gone multiple times. Earlier this year, I floated a cholesterol brain injury company called Narada, where they're testing of human cells based on the FDA drugs in the States has actually proven successful. So this company has, I think, quite a revolutionary breakthrough in cholesterol as a inhibitor. I know I read a lot of comments saying that cholesterol drugs kill everyone and there's a big cholesterol conspiracy theory. Well, I'm not going to abide with that. But I've actually put $120,000 of my own money into that stock. I've paid higher than where it is now. They actually put out their annual report today, and I think I'm the 14th largest shareholder. But what I want to make clear to viewers is my interests are aligned with my clients. Call me crazy. I've just got a great instinct on this company. I love management. I like John Moore and Dr. Christopher Cox in the US, what they're doing. The science seems to be working. The other side of this company is interesting because Danny Frawley, who had that tragic car accident and died, it turns out he has CTE. So a lot of, you know, you can say a lot of boxers and Polypharma had that as well. And that can only be diagnosed after death. So I think we're going to see a lot of interest in the brain, traumatic brain injury and stroke. Now, one area of medicine, Martin, which I think is going to boom, is anything to do with the long-term impact of COVID, based simply on the fact we don't know the long-term impact. So this is going to extend to respiratory. It's going to extend to fibrosis. It's going to extend to the lungs, the heart, and all organs. And I think that when you're backing the bright people in the biotech sector, as I hope am hopefully doing, I just think that's going to be where the boom sector is, and not trying to build six townhouses in out of Penrith or East Dubbo to try and flip for profits.
Yeah, good point. And as with all of those things, I think there's always going to be more complicated than the people perhaps first think, right? But that's just the way it is.
I mean, I operate in a niche environment. I've written books on it. I've just started doing Zooms for my clients and one-on-one. And I've had over 22 years, a lot of success. I also get punched up a bit along the way because if you're going to make 10 times return on your money, you've got to expect some pain. And during March, a lot of my good companies got cut in half. But funny enough, once something returns to reality, they're back over where we started. But it's certainly not an area for everyone. I know that I'm often touted as a snake oil salesman around the traps, but people need to separate that, they need to understand that the market, stock market, is made up of many markets, as is property, Martin.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. I mean, it's not one market, is it? Just a few comments that I've been watching. Quite a few people have asked, you know, lots of different questions. One or two were asking about the silver miners, so we might come back to them in a second.
Yeah, but sure.
just acknowledge Bryce, who basically said best content on the internet. Thank you very much. That's good. Mike DeFinder asked about recession or depression. We've sort of covered that a little bit. Death and Regret says, Tony, what is your opinion with small cap gold and silver miners and explorers and tips? Now, you sort of touched on it a bit. Anything else you want to add, or have you given that your dash on that?
I mean, I'm happy to share what I'm doing. I'm quite public in my suggestions. I mean, people can take it how you will. I love exploration. I think in Australia, based on silver, SVL is the small cap stock of choice where everyone will flock to. So that'll trade in relation to the silver price. And they have the Bowdens deposit, which probably the best thing some companies can do is not risk it by trying to mine the bloody stuff. A lot of uranium companies that left the uranium in the ground survived, and those that tried to mine it went under. So certainly that's one to look at. I do hold quite a lot of stock in a company called Red Metal, codes RDM. Now, they have 105 million ounces of silver. It is associated with the lead deposit in Queensland. I think it has a chance of becoming a mine. They've got Oz Minerals in joint venture with them. They just need some deep holes. Now, that stock went to 17 cents, is now back at 12.5 cents. But I should warn viewers that they are drilling a hole in Queensland looking for another Cannington silver mine. And if that hole is unsuccessful, the 12.5 cents shares, you might see back to 8 or 9 cents. So that's the risk you have. But if it pays off, obviously there's a lot of upside. One of the stocks, interestingly, that I raised quite a lot of money for at 15 cents called Staveley Minerals, had a massive copper discovery in October last year and went to $1.42. Now, during COVID, they're right back into the low 50s, and they just raised $28 million at 60 cents. Now, this is shaping up as a massive copper deposit in Victoria, shallow, and they are looking for a much larger system. And I think that company is at a very attractive valuation. I've known the managing director, Chris Cairns, for 16 years. I've backed him in his other company. So that's the other stock I'm buying. Code is SVY, so you can buy that around 52 cents. Outside of that, I've just raised some money for another high quality explorer called Minotaur Exploration. Code is MEP. They're trading at 5 cents. They've also got a joint venture with Oz Minerals. So what I like about the small cap stocks that are the high quality, you'll see like an Oz Minerals or a Sandfire come in and provide financial support. So I'm certainly right up to my neck in the exploration sector. I think that's where the decent risk reward is, where you can make 5-10 times your money with the downside risk of halving it.
And that's the point. But you keep referring to the management. You know the management. That's clearly a critical part, isn't it, for you?
Yeah, I've got right into it. Before I became a broker, I went and walked the West Perth precinct of the mining industry. And I actually interviewed 20 managing directors and actually wrote it up and turned it into a bit of a book. And what I've also been gifted with is the chance to actually MC gold conferences and biotech conferences as well. So what I've done is pretty much get to know everyone. And if I don't know someone, I know someone that does. And I'm lucky in the fact that during the dot-com bubble, every company with a website went through the roof. But I also, you know, early on, of course, I'm going to make some mistakes, but I actually learned to eyeball someone and think you're full of shit, or I don't like you, or you're not for real. And that's my IP that I've developed over 22 years, like the IP you've developed, Martin, in such a quick time.
That's sixth sense. It is hard to explain, but you know, you get a feel, don't you? You get it's almost a sort of a gut reaction rather than it being sort of methodical and scientific. It's really interesting.
It's a funny thing. I mean, I sometimes watch Home and Away and I can actually tell when someone's holding an empty coffee cup or an empty bag, or I can often pick the next line in a movie. I mean, let's face it. I'll throw a controversial line here. You know, there's no such thing as the supernatural because I think that $1 million reward hasn't been taken yet. But the only way to learn and to act and get a feeling for something is to experience it. And my advantage is talking to thousands of people on the phone who are fearful, greedy, and stupid.
Isn't that market psychology at work?
Well, as I said before, the market pretty much is a collective of people with absolutely no idea what they're doing. And I mean, it's just an amazing thing to talk to people every day. Sometimes I make 70 phone calls a day. I try and get to know everyone. I try and understand what their goals are. Pretty much everyone just wants to make as much money as possible without any effort. And that's not the case.
No, money for old rope doesn't happen very often.
Nice.
There was an interesting question from earlier on. I've lost it now. Hang on. Chris Lynn asked, do you know of Brain Chip Holdings, BRN? Have you come across them?
Yeah, up to 73 cents today. These were the autonomous vehicles that had a bit of a bubble and has since absolutely skyrocketed. So if you have a look at the web forums, that stock is probably the most discussed stock probably on the internet at the moment. And I actually read quite a funny post from someone saying that this company's almost capped at $1 billion with $15,000 revenue. And in any, you know, in this market, in this delusional market, that's probably fair value. And the other thing is my barista, not my barrister, tipped me that stock about 8 weeks ago and I didn't buy it.
So you win some, you lose some.
I looked at the price today and I thought, wow, and I saw the demonstrations. Holy shit, at one point, $1 billion valuation. Unbelievable. Look, I'm just saying, in that sort of trajectory, you have to be careful. But $1 billion valuation is like a company finding 10 million ounces of gold. So
yeah, puts it in perspective, doesn't it?
It does. You've got to look at people that tried to short Tesla or Amazon based on a lack of revenue. They've been wiped out.
Tonio, just as we now move into the sort of the last phase of the show, I want to pick your brains slightly more broadly on Western Australia, its position vis-a-vis borders, shutting everything off, and the political environment over there versus the rest of the country. Because it seems to me that we've got a bit of a fracturing going on at the moment between various parts of the country, you know, state by state by state. And of course, WA always has had a, you know, we're over there, we're unique, we're different sort of style. How are you reading that at the moment? And is that in any way impacting the decisions you're taking from an investing perspective or indeed more broadly?
Well, that's the best question I've ever been asked, Martin. I guess it comes from your experience. Look, our Premier has 90% popularity. And I actually saw on today's West Australian that our opposition leader, she was on the front page of the West Australian with 10% over her picture, Lisa Harvey. So look, McGowan has been tough talking. He did have some comedy in relation to a kebab. And I think that endeared West Australians to his attitude. Like he said, well, you can't have a kebab on a park bench in Victoria or Melbourne or something like that. Look, I think what's happening over here is going to do some damage. I just can't explain it. Here we are insulated with a premier whose absolute record popularity levels. Look, he does speak well. He does defend us well. He's trying to keep everyone safe. But at what point do you start to let go? And actually, one of his signers that does the sign language, she's become a celebrity now as well. So she gets stopped in the street. So look, let's look at it from a more serious perspective, Martin. I was driving this morning, and MinRes are actually advertising for people to go to mine sites on the radio. So you're not seeing the influx of people from the eastern states, and they're having to resort to radio advertisements to find employees. What's happened with our cafe culture is starting to get into full swing. You can go out Leaderville on a Friday, Saturday night. The place is buzzing. I grew up in the northern beaches of Sydney, and at this point, I was actually thinking before I came on that how distant I feel from the rest of the country. And I think you're absolutely right in saying that. And what's happening in Perth, we now have a looming rental crisis where year to year, based on July, there's 50% less houses for rent. And there was a headline a couple of weeks ago saying there's a rental crisis in Mandurah as well. People are stuck there because there's 1.6% vacancy rate. Oh, let's change the name to Dawesville maybe. So here we are. I guess at the moment we've got this superiority complex, and I think we're definitely removing ourselves from the rest of the country. And now we're faced with a rental shortage and a skill shortage. So I don't know how long it can continue on, but certainly, no, it's certainly not affecting how I'm investing. There's companies still out there drilling. Our mining industry is keeping the economy going as best it can. People here are going out and throwing money away. So a bloody good question, Martin. And I certainly feel for the people in Victoria. I speak to a lot of people in Melbourne who, even some real estate agents who tell it how it is, and unfortunately they're not going to be able to sell houses. All their businesses are under threat. We've still got a huge amount of retail and eatery spaces still vacant over here, but I'm just wondering how long we can keep it going, because it's only going to take one dickhead to cause our economy to go into lockdown. And I think what I've been doing is trying to get out and enjoy life as best I can before we're faced with a pretty dire future.
Mm. And that's really the point, isn't it? That, whether it's by accident or by design, at the moment WA is, locked down and relatively virus-free. But of course, it doesn't take much for that to turn around. I was watching today in the statistics in the UK, they've got 3,000 new infections a day in the UK. It's just coming up. And in fact, quite a few other places up in the Northern Hemisphere are seeing rises now. And interestingly, a lot of the infections are actually among younger people who basically have just given up on the social distancing and things. So, it feels like we're on a sort of a knife edge here in terms of it could fall either way. But I'm very intrigued as to the data coming out of WA. So I survey households, right? And the confidence levels in WA are significantly higher than in most of the other states, right? So there's clearly it's flowing through not only to psychology, but also even some of the economic variables that I'm seeing as well. So it is really fascinating, because it's like you're seeing two worlds, right? WA and the rest of Australia. And you almost think, well, hang on a moment, do you need a WA dollar? Do you need a different currency?
Yeah, I think to an extent it's certainly heading that way. As I said, I've had this incredible run with what I've been doing. My partner works in aged care, even though she's paid horribly under terrible conditions, she still has a job, and that's essential. But I do think that the way people are living here is very blasé. It's only going to take a slip up or some idiots that, I just hate to think what's going to happen with the spread of this virus, with sabotaging the economy or people's lives. I just don't think we've even got to that stage yet. But at the moment, yeah, we're enjoying life. Those that have a job have been bolstered. They've been stimulated. Our restaurant pub scene is vibrant. Certainly we missed out on the AFL Grand Final, but the hub here has been a success. You know, apart from the Collingwood coach playing, what do you do, play tennis with Alicia Molik? I mean, isn't it ridiculous? Absolutely ridiculous. But look, I think it's a fragile piece here in Perth and WA in particular. And more recently, they actually ran a story where people from Perth are actually moving regional now, and there's now regional bubbles forming because they're worried about the virus in Perth.
Yeah, as well. Interesting about that. Now, one other topic I just wanted to touch before we close. Now, you know, there is the Perth Mint over there, right? I don't know whether you saw, John Adams and I did a show on Interest of the People the other week, highlighting the fact that there are some gold derivative products that don't necessarily have gold directly attached to them, right? And it goes back to the RBA and who's leasing the gold and all those things. What's the WA's perspective on the Perth Mint?
Okay. No, that's a very good question. And I think when you go and look at investing in the Perth Mint, I'm actually quite fortunate into someone that I've had quite a lot to do with over a number of years, a guy called John Nolicio. Last I spoke to him was actually in the investments sector of the Perth Mint. And he actually explained to me all the allocated and unallocated precious metals products that you can buy from the Perth Mint. And you can actually have shared in a part of a silver bar, or you can have it totally allocated and you can have your online or your phone trading systems. So I've actually looked into those products for clients, and they're actually quite cost effective. I think on one of them, your yearly fee is about 0.9%. But bless John. I hope I haven't offended John. I just don't agree with everything he says. But no, we're pretty good mates, I think. But I actually don't go further into the conspiracy theories about, you know, JP Morgan Chase and all their silver derivatives and how it's going to blow up the world. I just look at each individual product. And luckily, someone I know quite well consults for the Perth and actually works for the Perth Mint. So I've had any fears I've had certainly have been rested.
Okay, very interesting. And just on that, and taking the conversation slightly further, what's your perspective on the old cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin, Ethereum, so that sort of area, right? Have you ever looked at those, or do you just think that's beyond the pale, as it were? Be interested in your perspective on that.
Geez, you're bringing out all the big questions tonight. I actually spoke at a gold conference at Luna Park, which is an apt place for it. And this was 2011. And they actually had a speaker called Jeff Berwick, who got up, and I was absolutely blown away by his presentation. And if you look at the price then, I haven't got a chart of what it was, but at some point, it wasn't far off being in the cents. And he stood up and outlined the case for Bitcoin. And I think everyone thought this guy was Looney Tunes. So, and then you had stories of people buying a pizza with Bitcoin. Look, I think in this environment, there's certainly a place for it. But, you know, I met some people, we're having breakfast, and they said, well, I just bought Ripple at $3.52. What do you think? And I said, well, get the hell out now. Because what that did, it took down a whole generation of 30, 40-something women and people with blue hair at JB Hi-Fi, and even those without blue hair and tats at JB Hi-Fi, were trading crypto. So, but what we did, we had, 1,500 plus ICOs, and 99% of them were absolute shit. And we had people that were creating these Bitcoin vending machines, for God's sake. So, look, I know there's a few people that will stand up at conferences wearing Todd Sampson's T-shirt and a linen jacket and will talk the virtues of Bitcoin and other cryptos, my theory is that it went crazy in 2017. Now the distrust in currencies and governments is only going to escalate. And I think Bitcoin and other current cryptos will be a case of pass the Ponzi. But I think, look, as part of any highly diversified, highly speculative portfolio, I think it probably deserves its place.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah. And, you know, I keep saying, of course, elsewhere on the channel that I think the potential for digital currencies in various forms are quite astonishing. But whether we've actually seen anything yet, I guess, is the question. Okay, last question for tonight, Tony. In the last quarter, we have seen many, many new investors, not here in Australia and around the world, basically invest for the first time, the Robin Hoods, you know, as some of them have been called, taking their government checks and they stuck it in the stock market or they stuck it in wherever, right? Now, for every buy, there's a sell. So I'm wondering whether the smart money is selling out whilst the dumb money's buying in. What do you think?
Well, the problem is, I see dumb money can go on exponentially. You only have to look at Sydney and Melbourne property prices. So the way I see it is, if people can take a bankrupt company such as Hertz and send it from 50 cents to over $8, you know, stupid is as stupid does. And also, we're starting to see articles of reasonably attractive male and females, let's give it each way, that are now the new face of stock picking. And I think, look, in a way that with social media and low cost brokerage or virtually zero commission, people can easily change their mind 20 times a day and it's still cost effective. But I watch market depths. I watch all the online chat. I know what's happening. People are buying a stock at 5 cents, trying to sell it at 6 cents or even worse. And to me, people are jumping on anything that's moving, any hint of a gold result. They're going to try and buy the stock to sell it higher. And to me, if you buy something and try and sell it a minute later, you're gambling. And I've actually had probably the longest running joke in financial history is that once you see single mothers or single fathers pushing a pram coming over the hill, and Tracy Grimshaw says, meet the new face of finance and investments, you know it's time to ring the bloody bell.
Oh, what a
picture.
Well,
it's true. I mean, look, I agree. Yeah. I'm not put off in the fact that sometimes I might pick the wrong stock, but there's plenty of volume to take out your trash. I'm just trying to keep my clients level-headed, keep backing management, quality, realize that what we're going through is certainly unprecedented. No one knows the roadmap out of this. I mean, what? Victorians are being allowed to do 2 hours exercise a day. But besides bodybuilders, who the hell exercises for 2 hours a day anyway? I mean, I just don't get it. And then, you know, when you're seeing Oshies from Woolies advertised for $15,000, rare ones, we know the flow of stupid money will never end. But look, in all fairness, this is serious times. Assets are overvalued. There is a window to get out. We're being artificially propped up by government money. And unfortunately, the floodgates are going to open.
Yeah, and probably sooner than we might think. Tony, I really appreciate your time this evening. That's been certainly very entertaining, very educational, and a lot of people have acknowledged that on the chat. We got more than 1,137 at the peak, so well done. That's
you're going to send Cookie Boy broke.
Well, no, he's not. I don't think he's contributing tonight, so luckily. But we did get Bryce, who actually was throwing in $2 each time there was a swear word dropped. So it ticked up a little bit.
Well, I've made a promise. I like to be quite colourful, but I'll never drop the F or C bomb anywhere.
So. Appreciate that. That was really, really very, very good tonight. And, you know, all the people on the channel have been acknowledging that. So thank you, Tony.
Absolute pleasure.
Now, if people want to get hold of you, what's the best way to do that?
Just follow me on Twitter, Tony Lecantro. I'll go under Lecantro, Tony. I've got a shitload of videos on YouTube. If they put my name into YouTube, I do regular market updates on that. You're most welcome to send me an email, but since I've been on your channel, I've actually been swamped with new clients, Martin, and I'm getting towards the point where it's getting risky to take too many on because I mightn't be able to provide the high level of service I have been in the past. So certainly it has worked for me, but I take people on between $3,000 and $4 million. So if you fall somewhere in there, I'm happy to talk to you. But if I don't like you, I'm not going to deal with you because no amount of money is worth dealing with someone you don't like. And life's too short.
Yeah.
Life's too short for that. But really appreciate it, Martin.
Well, Tony, thank you very much indeed. And keep safe and keep... We'll chat again, I'm sure, quite soon, just in terms of finalising the show tonight. Tony, thank you very much for your time. Really appreciate it. I'm just going to come across there and take that off there. And just in terms of next week, so that people are aware, we'll be running a show there where we'll be looking at the latest household confidence data. We'll have our online tool available, including things like the postcode, and all of those other good things. And that means that hopefully we'll be able to take the conversation further with regard to the data. And it's great to have so many people on the show. Thank you very much for spending time with us tonight. Yeah, with that said, have a wonderful evening. Come back next time, next Tuesday, for the next show. And this is Martin North and Tony Lecantro signing off. Take care.